Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
They were saying how with niching, it helped them to create a different point of contact with someone, but also be able to focus and support this person better. So it sounded like to me it helped to open more doors than it did to close it.
Have you ever met someone and thought their job sounded cool? Or perhaps you're wondering how you can get to a position that doesn't seem to match any of the qualifications you have at the moment. Well, if so, this podcast is for you.
We found some people with jobs that you might not necessarily know about or expect people to have, and we're going to ask them about how they got there.
Welcome to What Do They Do? A podcast about jobs and how people got them.
Welcome. So, another episode. I'm really, really excited today to have Linda Lynn joining us. Welcome, Linda.
Hello. Hello, everyone.
So, Sunday morning dedication from Boston, joining me as I'm based in the UK. So, a bit of a Sunday afternoon for myself. And without further ado, Linda, what do you do?
So, hi, everyone. My name is Linda, and I am running a brand strategy studio. So we're focused on building restaurant brands that create a more vibrant community in our neighborhoods. So that's what I do.
And I hope everyone immediately can understand why we wanted to speak to you and get you on, because I think it's a really interesting for me in a few ways. So first of all, so brand strategist is probably something people are familiar that is a role. So you've got a brand strategy agency. It's interesting that it's focused on a particular niche around working with restaurateurs and in the food industry. So I think that's interesting in that you've got that focus. So I'd love to explore that first of all. What got you into focusing on that particular market and sector?
Great question, Ben. So originally, I actually used to be a generalist before I started to niche down. And I worked a lot, personally speaking. I actually was working a full-time job in marketing and advertisement. And in that journey and career, I found that we were working on some projects that were around small businesses. And I felt this deeper connection to local businesses in a way that I never felt with something like a bigger corporate project. And so I found myself in between this moment where I was like, wow, I'm creating all this amazing work with an incredible team on dream projects I would never dream of working on. Unfortunately, I signed a lot of NDAs, so I'm going to dance around this just a little bit. And the thing was, the time that I spent with these local business owners really had me in a moment of seeing how much of a deeper impact as a creative, I like to call myself a creative, but as a creative, building that long-term plan for them, it felt for me that it can not only drive a business forward, but I also noticed the community around it start to change versus something like working for a contract with a bigger company. It's kind of all just numbers and just how much can we sell versus how much can we help. So that's kind of where I found myself, just like living and working in that in-between area. And the truth is, I actually didn't want to like let go of working with all these like bigger brand names, because it was just like, wow, I got to work with X, Y, and Z. It was definitely like, because I'm pretty young, of course, and working in that industry is just like, I'm so starstruck. I mean, who has that opportunity to say, oh, I worked with like so-and-so, so.
Yeah, I do some workshops, and there's this corporate client versus smaller client quandary, and obviously there are some benefits of the big corporate client, but it's really interesting to hear you talk about, I suppose it's being closer to the impact and seeing that impact, and that impact not purely being a bottom line related issue as well. So the clients you have now, are they exclusively independent restaurants and food outlets? And geographically, like, how far are they spread?
Currently, this whole niching process actually took some time, because the transition from working with bigger brands, scaling it down to smaller brands, I also noticed that there needed to be a very specific kind of treatment with that. And really working in the details than working on just the bigger picture. And a lot of these clients that I work with are independently owned. And we really, really focus on working with those types of clients, because we believe that with the way things are moving, I feel like in the United States specifically, we're talking about the fast food industry and how quickly things evolve and change. And unfortunately, that comes with the territory of buying up land and kind of kicking out the community that has been living there for quite some time. And that's definitely a topic that's kind of not talked about enough, especially in this industry, just because it's kind of like overshadowed with let's develop the land and bring in more jobs. So there's a bit of a gray area that's happening here. And a lot of these local independent restaurants, they're located in different cities and things like that. I'm like, I'm doing my best not to like give out too much information to respect the privacy of people doing business. But it's kind of being able to kind of combat against a lot of that overdevelopment happening in these neighborhoods and communities. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, so like I'm based in the UK, and there's certainly an aspect of high streets in towns and cities in the UK looking very similar. You know, there's a Starbucks. Let's go. You know, on every corner, there's these similar brands that pop up and take up these places. What I've noticed over here is that if you take certain parts of London, you might be more likely to see little pockets of independent retailers. There, again, you'll see the same on certain strips. So is it that there are more independents like hidden away in the sort of, I mean, you're based in Boston. So like, do you see that within Boston, there are more independents and more possibility of that? Or is it actually sort of heading outside of the city that it's more possible?
So we work with surrounding states. So more so my clients are more in another state over, which is, it's the smallest state in the United States, and it's called Rhode Island. It does get mixed up a little bit with New York and thinking that it's Long Island. And the thing I've noticed is that in Boston, there are smaller pockets for these communities to thrive on. But in recent years, and it's actually happening very quickly, in recent years, there's been a big boom on development and turning the city more into something like a mini New York City. So a lot of these neighborhoods are shifting, and now these newer buildings are coming up and are hosting something like a Starbucks, as you could say. Which is quite funny, because there's a lot of Starbucks here. I'm not going to lie.
I think there are a lot of Starbucks everywhere.
Oh, agreed, agreed. Whereas something like this smaller state called Rhode Island, it's very fascinating. It's about 85% small business. And there's not that many bigger brands in there, such as like these fast food chains. If anything, I feel like these two states are quite the opposites of one another. But I feel like Boston can learn a lot from this smaller state of Rhode Island and what it means to support a small business and continue to reinvest back into your communities.
So is that because Rhode Island, sort of market share wise, is not seen as worth the time of the bigger corporations? Or is it something that the state has legislated for to prevent kind of all the big companies just taking over everything?
Yes, great, great question. So part of it is the legislative does its best to kind of push off against these bigger corporations from coming in. But as you've probably heard, Amazon is building all these like warehouses across the states. So Amazon has already broke through and have created a massive facility over in Rhode Island. But I will say, despite the legislative kind of trying to work against this, a lot of it actually comes from the people. And I have never seen in my entire life such a purpose-driven community to want to be fighting on the ground for their local coffee shop. I'm just going to use that example. Local coffee shop or local bakery. And so that's how so many of these businesses are able to be able to float with the water, is because it's not just the state, but deeply it's with the people who believe in a small business. It's truly incredible. I feel like I'm always studying and learning from these local natives. I feel like I'm a like data research scientist or something.
Therefore you're getting all these insights. I mean, it's interesting you say it's what the people want. And I think I imagine a lot of people, when you see a kind of independent coffee place or restaurant, I mean, my wife and I, when we traveled up the west coast of the US, found this family run restaurant on the harbor in a little place called Bandon in Oregon. And it appeals, you know, we really, like, that stands out as a memory. That was 10 years ago now, but I still remember that family run restaurant with the fresh caught fish from the day. So I feel like, you know, that makes sense, but it's interesting. Are you seeing a shift then from people? We always maybe had that inkling, but now it's actually kind of coming through. And I suppose that's maybe more relevant question is that what you're supporting them with as a brand strategist, is to cut through and kind of connect what people want with these places that are providing it?
Yes. So great question again. Ben, you're just nailing these questions right on the head.
You're very good.
And actually kind of going back a little bit to what you had talked about, is that even though it was 10 years ago, you still had that memory and that recollection of what experience a small business felt like. And honestly, I kind of wonder how long they've been there for, as I've heard some small businesses out in California have been there for a couple generations. So it's like great grandfather or great great grandfather or something like that. And one of the things that we're really focused on is we see that there's still a relationship to be built between customers and the actual brand itself. And to be honest, we don't know what the legislative is going to do next, what could change next. But what we do know is that we can definitely bet on the people who live and grew up in a specific neighborhood, depending where these places are. And so we're really focused on positioning these small business owners to be the leaders in their community and advocate for what they believe in is going to help reinvest back into the community. And as an example, I feel like I'm getting a little too high level, but as an example is one of my clients, she is a mother with two kids, and her husband are pretty successful. They've run, they have three food trucks, and they've transitioned into having their own restaurant. And the reason behind the business was because they wanted to celebrate the culture of their neighborhood. And through that, they've established a point where it's a community cultural hub where people come in and they get to know and they meet each other and also share a good meal, of course. But more likely, she's more focused on bringing people together to really share their experiences. And it's been such an amazing experience for me personally to watch. But I work in the background, so I'm sort of just pushing and supporting them through their journey and what they believe in to help kind of grow and nourish their surrounding neighborhood. So let me know if that was a lot, though. I feel like I dropped so much.
No, that's all good. There's normally by now on the podcast, I would be asking people what they were doing, what they wanted to be when they grew up. But I think it kind of says a lot about that it's an really interesting niche you're working in, that I've still got about 10 questions I'm trying to filter out of my head as to where to go next. I think the question I want to go with next is, so there's really interesting that example you gave of this family with building up front up to three trucks and then a restaurant. To get to that point then, as for your agency, and you talked about the niching process took quite a while. Could you talk a little bit about what that process was? Because I'm constantly talking to people who are like figuring out their niche and how they go about it. And it's interesting you say it's a long process. And I think it might be interesting to kind of understand the highlights and the kind of lowlights of what that process looked like to get to where you are now, where you're working with these very specific like family-run businesses.
Yes. So when I mentioned niching for me has been such a journey, it really has. And I know sometimes we hear about like, oh, it's just super easy. It was like, I knew I was supposed to go into this. I'm going to be honest here. I had no clue, especially coming from the fact that I was a jack of all trades, working in the advertising marketing sphere. As some of us know, we have to be the jack of all trades. And the thing that really propelled my niching forward was that not being everything for everyone. And honestly, that was a very hard pill for me to swallow, because part of me was worried about, okay, what if I'm just no longer relevant anymore? I think that was a huge, huge factor for me, of course, especially seeing the way things move and quickly develop in this sphere of marketing and advertising. I think that was just deeply my fear of it all. But I met someone in this journey of niching, an incredible, incredible person. And they had the same journey as I did, and they were explaining about how much more fulfilled they felt closer to working with someone than just working for everybody. And little by little, and they're doing so well, by the way, and they're actually based in the UK as well. And they were saying how with niching, it helped them to create a different point of contact with someone, but also be able to focus and support this person better. So it sounded like to me it helped to open more doors than it did to close it. And I had to take a look at myself that, well, who are the people that I want to work very closely with? And that was the tricky part, because worked everywhere around the different topics. I was like healthcare. I was also like all these like brands and lifestyles and things like that. And looking at it, I noticed that there was a pattern of effect that was happening for me. And I noticed that the points in those effects made me super happy and felt really connected was community. Because if we look at healthcare, or specifically public health, because that's what we were focused on, the whole purpose of public health is to support and help navigate the community from getting from point A to point B. And that's what I really enjoyed, was that transition and sense of community there. So I knew I had community on my plate, but I'm like, okay, this is still too vast. So I needed to take a step further and really dive deeper. So what I'm doing here is I'm sort of creating these layers for myself to really deeply understand what do I want to be close with. And specifically, I knew that because it's community, I reflected back on all the projects I used to work on in these communities, in these small businesses. And I noticed that the one thing that gets me super excited is food. Like, I know it from the back of my hand to the front of my hand. and all that. So I was like, okay, let me just dabble in it just a little bit. And then that little bit became, okay, I just want to do this for the rest of my life.
No, anything that gets you to that statement is a process worth taking, because I think that's essentially what everyone's working for, right? Is, can I get to that realization? That's really incredible. And thank you for kind of sharing a little bit of an overview of that. How long roughly did that process take? I mean, you're probably still on it now, but what kind of timeline should people be thinking about for this?
So this one's going to be a huge wake-up call. It took me, okay, so it's 2023 now. It took me about 4 years. 4 years to figure it out. And it's all because I needed to allow myself to be able to test the waters on different industries and allow myself to say yes or no. So that's why it took me so long. But I'm really glad though.
There's a slightly sort of different but the same conversation with Lily, one of the previous guests, who founded Jack Fertility. So she's from the US, North Carolina, I believe, but I might have to put a fact-checking center moment in. Ho-ho, Ben here. So Lily did grow up in North Carolina, but she also was born somewhere else, moved around before she went there. Here's the information you need from Lily's episode.
I guess some early years in a nutshell is that I was born at the beginning of my dad's PhD. So we were in the state of Georgia in the US, moved to Ireland actually for my primary school years, which was an amazing experience in Cork, and then moved back to North Carolina, which is where my mom's family is from. So that was really special to be able to be there in Winston-Salem. And then we moved when I was 12 to a really rural town called Due West in South Carolina.
But she went through various different trajectories, and what seems to be her theme was she kept on ruling things out, but she wouldn't rule them out just sort of from a distance. Like, she got on the verge of doing a medicine degree and then realized that that was not the route she wanted to take, and then she went down the law route, but kind of almost became a partner in a firm, then decided that wasn't the way to go. So along the journey as well, then it sounds like there were certain bits of doing, like you mentioned about the research you do, and you're quite precise with that. Was that also a process of figuring out what you didn't want to do, as well as finding that community and food part along the way?
Yes, a lot of it had to also do with research, because I'm not going to lie, being a creative, my heart is on one page and then my mind is on the other page. So my mind was more so thinking about, okay, is this realistic? And I don't know if you've heard of this, but there's this book called Ikigai.
I've heard of it, but I've not read it.
Okay, wonderful. So it's an incredible book that really helped me to find the intersection of what my passions was and also, I guess, realistically, what could also be profitable as well. Because I know from prior experiences, picking up some of these jobs before going full-time was noticing that certain projects was fulfilling, but also unfortunately was not profitable. And so I felt like it was a cat and mouse game that I was like always chasing, or it was just so much chasing. So I needed to really find that balance in this niche as well. And the balance for me was specifically the profit and is it fulfilling, but also is it something that I can add value to and can help continue to evolve? Because if the industry is stagnant and I just play the whole cat and mouse game where I'm always chasing, then all of my efforts would just kind of flop. And that was something I didn't want to burn out from either, even if I was passionate about it.
Yeah, I think that you talked about, like, is it profitable or not? And I think, and then you talked about the 4 years worth of going on this. I suppose initially, if you, you know, you go back 4 years and tell yourself, brand strategist for small family run, like, restaurants, like the logical mind is saying, sounds nice, but I'd worry about whether that's going to pay the bills. And I suppose that's the bit you're kind of constantly fighting with in this niche journey, is you want to say yes to stuff because, you know, we've all got some bills to pay. But really interesting that finding that kind of passion point and purpose, actually. There's a book that talks about passion versus purpose. I forget what it is. I'll try and get it from you. I feel like you might know that one.
I did hear about that. It's actually on my list to read because I'm just kind of curious after reading Ikigai. So I have heard of it. So
I'll get a link in the description, or if I remember it before we finish, well, I'll share it over. But so, okay, maybe a convenient point then. So we've had this, obviously talk about the business, the process you've been on to go from sort of the corporate work down to the specific work you do. If we jump back then to, let's say, sort of Linda at school, what did you imagine you were going to be growing up? What was the plan back then?
So I have to giggle just a little bit about this. As I also had a similar conversation with Jing, she's like, oh, how about back then? And I was like, well, Linda back then was pretty ambitious. And I mean, I'm not ambitious now, but in a different kind of ambitious. And essentially what it was like was for me was when I was younger, I actually, so let's put like an age stamp on this. So how young are we thinking?
Oh, I mean, was there ever a point when you kind of would have said, I definitely want to be a particular thing? Was there ever a point when that was the case?
Okay. Yes, there was a particular point in that case. So I think when I was younger, I really, really wanted to be an art director.
Okay. Now that's not necessarily as obvious. So did you have art directors in your life, or like what was the influence that kind of drew you towards that?
So the influence that drew me towards that was, well, first off, I didn't know what art director job this was or anything. It was more like I was back then I was actually a coordinator, an event coordinator. And I just really enjoyed being able to organize, facilitate, and then execute with a team. And to me, it felt at the time amazing. Like I just absolutely loved it. Spent hours on it. And I remember my friend, she said to me, she's like, Linda, you're going to be like an art director one day. And I looked at her and I was like, what is that? Yeah. I don't know what that is. Because the thing was, I was too young to understand what that was, because I haven't even hit like university yet. Like I don't know what I want to go to school for exactly. I just want to enjoy and hang out with friends. So at that moment, I was like, yeah, I want to be an art director, thinking it was something similar to like the event coordinator thing.
So I'm event coordinator, but pre-university. So were you organizing events like during high school? Is that kind of the time period we're in?
Yes, I was helping to organize events in high school.
Is that just a role within the high school that you could kind of apply to be on the events team, and that's what you just took on?
Yes, that's sort of like where I had taken on. And it's kind of funny because when I first had entered university, my university period, I also took on an event coordinator role, and that just kept going until I graduated.
What type of events, both at high school and university, did you get involved with?
So for high school, for me, it was, oh my gosh, it was like everything, but it still had to do with like the arts and entertainment industry. So one of them was setting up workshops for students, for younger students in the area. So we would come in on the weekends as, of course, this was like 100% volunteered, but we would come in on the weekends to help volunteer and teach students on, I don't know, anything between something that's creative with writing or being artistic or pottery, which I'm not great at. Not a pottery instructor. I learned the hard way.
That's a tough medium, I've found.
Yes. I remember trying to teach it and my poor back was hurting because you have to push the pressure into it. oh man, that was a time.
So, I mean, I'm already getting a sense of a bit of community coming into your work then at high school and into university. So one of the themes you've eventually come back to. The other one then, food-wise, what are any particular food themes that run through your earlier life and where your kind of love of food come from?
Great question. So my family immigrated from outside the US, from a smaller country in the Southeast Asia called Cambodia. And during that time, when they had immigrated over, they were coming in as refugees, if I'm understanding correctly. And my grandmother used to own her own restaurant. And so growing up, they're Buddhist, so my grandmother specifically would take me to the temple like every weekend, and she would teach me how to essentially food prep for a whole community. And I would be the little girl helping her with like cutting things or cleaning things, and I would always be next to her. And when it came time, like lunchtime, I would be the one helping her to scoop and then help serve all the elders in this temple. And through that, that's sort of what I kind of grew up with, is for a long time, I've been instilled with that restaurant hospitality in me. And so as I've gotten older, I've always packed a ton of food and would share with my fellow classmates or friends, and especially during my university period, as you know, trying to balance school, trying to work a part-time job, also trying to graduate on time, which is like sometimes impossible.
there's plenty to contend with.
Yes, definitely. I look back and I'm like, how did I survive this? How did I do this? Why did I do this? I'm kidding. But there was always these smaller pockets of moments where we would all sit down as friends and just eat together. And those were the moments that I cherished the most. It was just one of those moments where you like look around and you see your friends laughing and talking about things, or we're catching up on things and we're all just sharing a meal. And it's so funny to say, but I don't know how we managed, but we would go out to eat like maybe a few times a week, which of course got pretty expensive. But how we did it was we would kind of break up the cost of the food and kind of share with one another. So one person or two people would break up the cost of buying like a large rice bowl, and then we'd break it up and we would share amongst ourselves. Someone else would get pizza, break the cost of pizza with someone else, bring that. And so it always felt like this moment of just sharing with one another and just being able to just be with each other. And even though we were all doing our different things, we always found time to just sit down.
Did the memories of that and the memories of supporting your grandma, did they come into your niching process? Like you actually going, oh, wait, that was a highlight of my life that I want to get back.
Yes.
In some way.
Such a great, great moment for me was realizing what I wanted back. And I noticed so of course I'm in my mid-20s. I noticed as once we all graduated from university, it was sort of this fleeting moment where time just sped up, and then you just don't see your friends anymore. But from time to time, we would ask, when's a good time for us to sit down and catch a meal together? And I felt like in those moments, it was like I was kind of getting back pieces of the past, but more with matured relationships with friends. And so I thought for myself during that niching process, what do I miss for myself, but also can share with others that this is a possibility as well, that this is another option for someone to also experience, but through their business.
So from those moments then of connecting with friends and trying to get that back, what was the route that you took? Like you said, you worked sort of more generally across marketing. Did you major in something relevant to that? And then was it just sort of get a job at a big agency before you got to this point now?
So the university I went to was kind of more of a general degree. So it was a general marketing degree. And then how it worked is you kind of had to like pick and pull what classes you might think you might need. So I sort of picked up classes that I thought I might need. But in reality of it all it wasn't until I started picking up jobs that I felt like I was interested in exploring. And I think, oh, wow, I gotta like go to the beginning. But my first job was in marketing, and it was more of a general marketing, but it was for private education. So meaning like it's marketing for schools, private schools that are in higher education. So things like trying to pull out different names. So we have like Harvard University here. I mean, Harvard Law. We have Yale. So private institutions that rely on outsourcing marketing. And that was like sort of my first part-time job, was working in something very similar to that. And I think it was a huge, I will say it was really scary. because everything I learned in school was just not applicable. I can't even pronounce it because I'm getting nervous thinking back to when I was like that age. Yes.
Well, I'd be really intrigued. So I did a civil engineering degree. And I did work as a civil engineer for a period of time. But again, it felt like everything I needed on the job was not related to anything I'd actually studied. So I don't know whether that's true for a lot of people listening. I mean, we have people on, actually, you mentioned a kind of generalist degree that you could then pick out some modules that were relevant. Brittany Boeing, who came on the podcast, one of the previous episodes, said the same. She wanted to be a talk show host. Was her kind of growing up what she wanted to be. So she went, did this generalist one and picked, but it, again, then went off and did something completely different. So it feels like a lot of the guests we've spoken to, the degree is not necessarily the of entire relevance to what they go to do next. It's part of the reason we started the podcast, to be honest. Dean and I were both teachers for a period of time, and then we moved into training and now do other stuff. But it was that kind of reflection on what do people actually do now, and where does education really prepare anyone for it? So that was our kind of intrigue in asking people kind of what they do and how they got there, because just what you said, there seems a lot of education that people go through and then come out the other end and go, I don't know where this fits in.
This is so accurate. And I like how you mentioned how when you both had asked, like, what are people doing now? And honestly, to reflect on that, it's funny because that was sort of my epitome or epiphany. I'm not sure which word to use, but it was sort of my moment when I was just like, it was a huge shock to me because I was like, wait, what are people doing now? And at that moment, I was like, wait, oh no, please don't tell me I just spent all this money on a private education. I remember talking to my boss of that time where I was like, I'm going to be so honest with you. I apologize. I'm not as experienced as I thought I was. So I'm a little bit having a little imposter syndrome happening right now. And he had said to me, he's like, don't worry about it, Linda. You know, we don't expect you to know all the things.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
We do expect is for you to learn what we do and then take that into your own account. And so at that moment, I was like, oh, huge relief. Like, I was like, oh, okay, great. Okay, great. So we all, you know, cats out of the bag. I don't know what I'm doing, and that's okay.
Yeah, that's what we expect as employees.
And I kind of wish, this is just a personal note, but I kind of wish that we were a little bit more transparent in these, even though I'm not working a traditional job anymore, I wish that companies and employers would be a lot more transparent about that, because I realized that in my whole career journey that nobody really knows what they're doing. We're kind of just, you know, kind of shimmying along and then going as we do, or we do as we go, or something like that. So, yes.
Well, some job descriptions are huge and quite intimidating. Yeah, I mean, like yourself, I'll get into this whether we are like, but I'm now freelance, so I don't have to go through the whole applying for a job. But occasionally, you know, when maybe you're between contracts or pieces of work, you always have a look. And I just don't think I'm qualified for anything based on the job descriptions. There's the question I was coming to then. Do you now have employees or just contractors working with you on the brand strategy?
So great question. I currently just have part-time contractors working with me, just because as a creative running a business, out of full disclosure here, the whole taxation is very confusing. It's very difficult for me to navigate. Just not that long ago, I switched from, this is just like a tax bracket thing, but I switched to LLC, and that has its own hurdles, essentially. And being a creative, I feel so bad for my tax person, but being a creative, I swear I give him a heart attack, but being a creative, they're sort of trying to figure out how we do business. And so there are sometimes limitations that happen there. And specifically, like, based on my business model, I work very digitally. Strategies are run over Zoom. Everything's just done digitally. So to them, it's like, where's your office?
I feel like there's a lot of that expectation still of like, you know, where are you based? Wherever, really. In the UK, so I have a limited company, which is, I think, is the equivalent of LLC. But there's also sole trader is an option, which is kind of not setting up a company. So sole trader is an option for some people who freelance as well. But yeah, it's like trying to navigate all of this. And for, I mean, maybe if we're, you know, as we pin down our audience, for those people in the corporate situation like you were, thinking about the next steps, I wouldn't say we can possibly provide them with clarity, but it works itself out, right?
It does. It's a whole wave. You're just rocking with the wave and just hope that it ends out fine.
Now, I feel like I've gone off on a couple of tangents now. We were talking about, obviously, your journey, but I've got another tangent for you. You talked about, you know, the work you can be delivered quite digitally. And pre to pressing record, you mentioned traveling around Europe and also some upcoming travel as well. So are you able to combine work and travel? Is that something that you ever do?
Great question. I feel like that the industry that I'm in, I'm able to combine work and travel. I mean, the one downside to it is just time zones, of course. But after that, it's not that very difficult for me. As I always return back to where I'm living or where I'm doing business. And like, for example, as long as I have, it's a silly saying, but as long as I have Wi-Fi, I should be good.
Yeah, there's that hierarchy of need, isn't there? I think someone's added on Wi-Fi along the top or the bottom.
Yes. 'Cause I've kind of structured this business where it can run online. So, for example, I use Notion. Oh my God, I don't know what I would do without it, but it is my bread and butter. It's my project manager and tracker. And essentially, it's how I communicate with the team and also how I communicate with clients as well. And sort of having a centralized location where I can do business and then work with contractors, that's truly all I need, really, to really help run this business online. So I am able to travel and do business. But personally, I like to kind of use the time for traveling as a way to kind of separate myself a bit, but also give myself time to like learn and absorb in more information than just like, okay, pockets of work and then mixing work with this. I think in the beginning it did become too much for me, but now I've now time blocked where work happens for this amount of time and then traveling happens for this amount of time, and this is the purpose of travel. I hope that was clear.
Absolutely, yeah. I think because there's this concept now of kind of the digital nomad, isn't there, where people are just popping up and doing their work in wherever they can find. And maybe those people are working in some of your clients' establishments along the way as well. But I think it's really important equally to step away, isn't it, and have time away being time away. It's very easy when you're running your own business to not quite ever switch off. Do you find you're good at switching off when you go?
I will say that has to be the most difficult part. If I'm being completely honest here, switching off, as much as I love being an entrepreneur, a business owner, it is sometimes really hard for me to switch off. And although I do say these are the working hours to contact us with, my brain, it's the whole, like, when you find your point of ikigai between work and play, I still get so passionate about work that after a certain time, I tend to do something work related for my own self. So it is a little bit difficult.
Maybe that's the difference then, of like defining the times when other people can contact you business related, you know, in relation to your business. And at least when you choose to do it, it's your choice and you're working on it under your own steam rather than there forever being sort of responding to everything. So Maybe there's a difference there.
Yes, I really appreciate how you mentioned the being responsive to everything. What I definitely have learned on this journey is not being responsive to everything. And there's just a time and a place for that. Like, for example, I felt like I was always going to miss out on some sort of news related to my industry. And I would be on social media for, for hours. Because I was just so glued to it, afraid that I might miss something. And I felt like I needed to be always responsive to what's been going on. But I realized that nothing really truly needs my attention. And that's kind of where the power of niching comes in for me, is it's able to set the boundaries for me. And although I'm not perfect, I want to just put it out there. I'm not perfect, but I'm relearning and retraining myself the boundaries that it does with that. Because the other side to niching is that not many people talk about is the ability to say no to more things so that you have more time to say yes to the things that actually matter.
Well, I imagine the barrier, or at least it was for me, of this niche idea is you feel like you're going to say no to something along the way that could be quite, I think more kind of financially might be quite good if you're niching. That what if this big option comes in and I'm saying no to it because I've niched. So it's really encouraging, I think, to hear that, of seeing that ability to say no as a benefit rather than just seeing it as a barrier.
Yes, most definitely. And when you meant financially, there was a time where, and this is like still like in my early stages of niching, where there was a client, very well established, I can't even say their names, very well established, has quite a few restaurants, like different kinds of restaurants, and they are perfectly wealthy in terms of what I could charge them. And one of the things I was my hardest lesson was with niching, and niching taught me this, was that numbers isn't something I should always be hung up on. And technically this client fit the person that I wanted to work with. You know, they're specifically in the growth stage of their business, which means they have the budget to work with me. They have an understanding of the industry. They have a diverse portfolio of restaurants, all that fun stuff. And financially, it's just not an issue. But I did notice one of the hard things was that, and I had to learn this lesson the hard way, but I needed to understand that money just wasn't the closing factor to our relationship. And what I meant by learn the hard way was that when I actually accepted the job, and I definitely suffered. I suffered with my poor team. I feel so bad. Thank goodness for them. But essentially, I noticed that our energy started to take a dip because we were no longer serving what our business is about anymore, what our brand is about anymore. And it took a really big dip because we were so focused on the fact that this person is very well known. They would look great on our portfolio, of course. The finances are all there, so it's a no-brainer. But in the end, we were no longer able to create quality work. And that was a huge lesson in itself.
I mean, it's, I suppose, in a way, good that you've been through that so you can see it when it's about to happen the next time. But it's interesting. There's some pieces of work where almost if someone said a blank check, how much would I need to pay you to make you enjoy this piece of work? And you can say nothing. there's no number big enough in the world that would make me, that would make this worthwhile, or I'd be willing to do it exclusively. And I think that's the, when you come back to what you did over those 4 years of understanding, I suppose, I mean, adding to what you said earlier, you said community and food, things that you'd always connected with very strongly in the past. But then also you mentioned more specifically just then about a business in their growth stage and kind of, do you have a fairly well-formed ideal client criteria now after kind of the process you've been through?
Yes, I do. And the truth is it's always changing because kind of going back to what you said before about what are people doing now? The thing with businesses that I absolutely love is that it's always evolving. But I definitely know the key pieces to who I want to work with is the number one thing is it profit over people for them? That is like, that's definitely my number one. Used to be my bottom, but now it's my number one because I had to learn things the hard way. Number two, it's definitely, and I know it has to kind of go back to number one a little bit, but it's definitely about what, how does their idea kind of relate to the community around them? Because I think branding is so, as amazing branding is, and it's been such a, branding is, has always been with bigger companies, with massive amounts of budgets, etc. But with social media, people are slowly and starting to understand what this could mean for their business. Now making this idea more generalized for people to tap into. And so I deeply believe that although they can have a great idea, is it about them? Or is this about creating a business that's going to help the community move forward? So it's a really tricky line there. Super tricky.
So when you've got prospective clients that you're having conversations with, do you have a relatively detailed kind of scoping process? Maybe more than just a scoping call where you obviously hear what they say, but then do you also do a bit of research on top of that and kind of put the pieces together as to whether that fits with the kind of the right client for you and your team?
So yes, I do have a deep scoping process because I learned the hard way. I used to think it was super easy and just like book a call, see if we're a good fit. And no. So what I usually do is I actually have someone who does this for me. But basically we kind of look at specifically businesses who are in the growth stage. And next, we kind of look at how engaging they've been and what they've engaged with, get a sense of idea. It's a lot of like information collecting. Also, we kind of gather back data on sort of the business relationships that they do, who they're involved with, things like that. And because working in this industry is a little tricky. Another thing that people don't know about is sort of the business politics that happens behind the scenes. And so we're very cautious of that because we're not trying to start anything. And so we kind of gather that back and I like to review that for myself and look at it as, okay, what are the talking points I can do to interview this person? And how can I get to know them better? So since I'm not mentioning any names, there's a prospective client that I'm looking at right now. Very, very nice. Personally, I actually like to go to these restaurants, or if they have like food trucks too, I'll go to their food trucks. And the nice thing is that they will never know it's me. I work very behind the scenes, so nobody knows it's me as the owner. And I would disguise myself in a sense of like, I would either sometimes send my friends to go pick me up an order, or kind of sit along with a group of friends and get a sense of what they are like when they run their business. And most of the time, it's just observing. I'm just being there to observe this environment, interactions, and things like that. But when I sit down, specifically this client that I'm looking at right now, they're talking about this really interesting thing about helping to help connect people to farms using their restaurant as the in-between. And so I'm interested in something like that. That definitely speaks to me. But I'm wondering, what are you doing behind the scenes? How are you doing this? So as a customer, I want to see what that experience is like. So yes, I am a little sneaky. I'm not going to lie. I'm giving out my...
What intrigued me is, obviously, for your business, you can literally go and really, to a large extent than maybe some other sectors, is get under the skin of the business. You can go to the food truck, you can go to the restaurant, and you can get a sense of how things work and the inner workings of it. But obviously, with the farm connection, the farming connection, is that maybe is it harder to actually go and observe that bit. But that's, I suppose that's for most people. So if I'm facilitating a workshop, that's the equivalent of me getting to go in and work with the team for a day before I even commit to what the workshop would look like, which is kind of, that would be gold dust. So that's kind of a really interesting insight that you get that I suppose some of us don't. It would be a little bit more covert for us to be able to do that, I suppose.
Yes. And unfortunately, I'm starting to step out from behind the business and be in the front of it, as I'm looking to definitely be that point of contact and create those relationships directly. So sadly, I will secretly be sending spies in my space, in my place. But yes, it's something where also, like, although I will say it does sound like such a time suck and doesn't sound realistic, I think in the long term, it's better to avoid early heartbreak.
I imagine equally people are probably listening thinking, I'd love to be your spy, because it involves going to cafes and restaurants, right? And then reporting back. There are worse gigs in the world. Nate, so now we go back onto the kind of food and restaurants bit and that niching process. And actually didn't go back in as, like in previous episodes, we've definitely kind of like gone through people's journey, but I think the work you're doing is fascinating. And I've kind of stuck with that because I've got lots and lots of questions to explore. If we shift the focus to looking forward a bit, then, what are the things on the horizon that you're particularly excited about, whether that's trends in the independent food industries that you're seeing, or just having done the niching process? I mean, I think I've, in a way, I might have made it sound in my questions like you're done, and I don't think anyone's ever done. So two things to have a final kind of look at is, yeah, what are you excited about in the industry that you're working in, and then what are the things you're working on? Because if we give the impression like, you know, that everyone's done and finished and there's a finishing point, then maybe we're being a bit disingenuous. But yeah, we're excited about.
So I am very, very excited. And I think this actually has to kind of go back to 2020. I know folks are like, I'm so over COVID. But I will say COVID did accelerate some of the things that has always been lingering and not really being talked about until it happens. So back in 2020, I'm just going to take a step back. Back in 2020, people were inside their homes, more connected digitally. So many people were spent so much time on their phones, etc. And because of that, kind of birthed the rise of small, locally small independent businesses. And the reason why I want to talk about that is because what's getting me excited is that people are realizing that there's another opportunity out there to be an entrepreneur. And what I mean by that is we're seeing this rise of independently locally owned businesses and the staggering effect of these like bigger brands such as, because it's in my industry, of like fast food industries like McDonald's and Burger King starting to feel really irrelevant. And they're panicking because they're asking themselves, how do we market to this next generation? How do we keep ourselves relevant? And I find that, this is me being cynical, but I find that exciting because now we're looking at it as, okay, how do we teach the people that they have the power with their own money to invest in what they believe in? And that is through the local brands that are being created every day.
I have a vested interest in that as my sister owns a cocktail bar in Birmingham in the UK. So it is, and it's in one possible intriguing part of that is, if I take my, I went to New Zealand for the Christmas period because my Welsh brother lives over there. And he wanted, when we were in Queenstown, he wanted to take us to Ferg Burger. So apparently this is like the best burger in the whole wide world. And it has a queue 4-5 blocks long. And it took an hour to get this burger. And this started as a very small kind of, I think, a van that has then got a sort of a physical space in Queenstown now. But at what point, if Ferg Burger goes to another city and another city and another city, what's that transition point that takes an independent owned business like the ones that you're talking about? Does it stop being that if it gets a certain size?
You know, that's a really good question. So we have something like that here in the States. And actually, not many people know about this, but have you heard of the burger joint called Shake Shack?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Wonderful.
I think there's one in London. I've been to one in, yes, London. There might be a couple in London.
Yes, there's a few in London, which is perfect. That's actually independently owned. It's not obviously marketed out there, but it's actually independently owned. And the thing is, I think you asked such a great question. It's like, at what point do you consider it not to be locally owned anymore? And personally, I look at it as the moment they open their business up to shares, where they're kind of splitting their market with a bunch of other folks who have their hands in your business, then unfortunately, that doesn't sound like you own the business anymore. If you have shareholders.
So that takes that, the influence to a wide, appealing to the board and the shareholders and expanding that out. Because that's, yeah, I think that'd be, I wonder if there was a list of various companies, food outlets, would we, like if we were asked like which ones are independent and which ones are corporate, and I don't know where we'd necessarily know where that line comes or what the influence of that is. That's an interesting one. So in terms of then the agency and next steps, without giving away trade secrets, what are your kind of next steps? Like, is there more in the niching journey, or are there some adaptations you need to make to the way that you work? What's on the horizon for you?
Great question. So what's on the horizon for me is, I mentioned a little bit about it during our conversation, is taking a step back from the whole working behind the scenes to working in front of the scenes for the business. Because I notice with the rise of new business owners and their ideas and things like that, we're looking to connect from people to people than just business to business. Because I feel like having those conversations firsthand is so important. And also in the long run, for what we're looking at it as, is definitely having more public conversations around what it takes to run a business in a food industry. Because you've probably heard about this, was when the pandemic happened, a lot of businesses were undercut. Unfortunately, a lot of them were forced to close their doors. But the reality of it was that our legislatives didn't quite see the purpose behind a food service business. And because of this like really outdated idea, so many, especially with inflation now, so many food service owners are at this weird in between where it's like, how do we continue to run our business when we don't feel supported? And I'm not going to lie, creating more food events for people to attend is great and all, but it doesn't solve the long-term problem, which is educating and raising awareness on how a restaurant really shapes the culture of its community. And food service business owners are super busy running their business, so they don't really have that kind of time. But I feel like as an independent business, we have that ability to do that. We have that ability to speak out and create this community where people can kind of lean into and feel like their voices are being heard.
That's really interesting. I did have, the reason I paused, I had a final question, but you threw me off it with that one. I'm going to have to do some good old editing on this bit, aren't I? So with that, it probably actually brings me to a question I probably should have asked right at the beginning, which is related to like you've articulated quite well there with these restaurants have a story to tell, but too busy to maybe get it out there. And that's where you come in. But that's my kind of interpretation of literally what you do. Probably worth adding this in. So is that a fair representation of roughly the day-to-day work? Is it story, creative storytelling around the businesses that you work with? Is like, what's the best way of explaining that?
Great question. I know brand strategy is a bit of a, it's a bit of a term that's still being explored here. And essentially what we do is, it's, I know the buzzword right now is like storytelling, but essentially what we do is we're focused on creating a brand out of these personal experiences from restaurateurs and turning that brand into a culture. So I think we hear a little bit about this about, I'm going to reference back to your co-partner in this podcast. He works at Google, right? And what I find fascinating is that Google has its own culture. I mean, yes, it does own like a X amount of, it's probably like $1 million building, and it has all the facilities and all that fun stuff. But essentially, what a brand is doing is it's creating something similar where it creates a culture within that space. And everybody's restaurants are so different. For example, one of our clients, their restaurant is about celebrating the local culture. So you'll get a taste of these different pockets of cultures happening in them that rotate every so month or so. The other person, really interesting, really fun, but they celebrate their childhood flavors. And so every time you go in, it's like you step back in time and you nerd out with all these folks who love the same flavors as you did. And it's absolutely adorable. It's absolutely adorable. But and that's what we do. We help create this culture for these brands and really connect that with every time a customer comes in. They don't just feel like they're a customer, but they feel like they're part of something bigger.
Thank you for articulating that. And I think it comes to me, when I go into establishments, they just feel different. But I think a lot of people find it very hard to articulate what that is. You know, when you go, oh, I like this particular place because, oh, I don't really know why. It just feels, but no, I suppose that's what you're saying. It's the culture, the feeling you get when you go inside that appeals and kind of hits you. And it's really interesting to know that there's a piece of work there, kind of teasing that out almost, those parts, and making sure that's visible. Linda, I really, really appreciate your time today. It's been fascinating. As you probably tell, I had a lot of questions, and maybe it's like many, many more I probably still need to ask. But I'm going to let you get back to your Sunday. Whenever we get to like the edit piece, we always kind of like want to give the episode more than just a title of the person's name. But I think there's going to be an interesting dilemma to like, is this one about niching? It feels like there's a good opportunity there. But then there's also kind of, there's finding your purpose in there too. And there's this big theme of the food industry and all that you've talked about there as well. So really, really interesting to see where we want to kind of pick out the highlights. But it's been absolutely fascinating to get a chance to talk to you and get a little insight into the role of a brand strategist and that process of working so passionately with the food industry as well. So thank you so much for coming on. And yeah, it's been a delight.
Thank you. I definitely appreciate like getting to know you a bit as well. It's been really interesting that you actually both had a background in teaching. I honestly didn't know about that when I was looking into it. So I find that so interesting, because I will say, just a personal side note, is that teaching right now looks so different, but it has such a deeper impact on students. I mean, you could be any age and you're still a student, but on people around the world. I mean, you mentioned Christo, and honestly, thanks to Christo, I'm where I am now. And Christo is just like a part of it, but it's the people who surrounded Christo that actually helped me get to where I am. So I'm extremely, extremely grateful. So yeah, it's really interesting. Really interesting.
Yeah, and if anyone that's not explored Chris's work, Christo, we'll put a link in the description, has his own agency, but then also various kind of communities that he's gathered together, particularly of creatives who are on that same journey that you're on. And there's the ability, I mean, so Linda, you've already, was it through the Future Pro group that you connected with Ying, or was that a relationship you had outside of that?
Great question. Yes, through the Future Pro group, I connected with Ying, and I mean, even through the pro group itself, I connected with so many people internationally that it literally kind of popped the bubble for me, living in my bubble. And then, like, the girl I had mentioned a while back, the person I mentioned a while back, who lives in the UK, and she was the one who really, like, opened my mind to niching. She's also part of the Future Pro group. Really, really incredible work that they do, actually. Really incredible.
I think, we're coming back to community again. That I think for anyone listening, whatever you're doing, there's a passionate community out there somewhere to connect with. And whether it's the Future Pro group, there's a workshop and master group that I'm connected with through a company called AJ and Smart, similar kind of thing. And there's the Christo that is valuable to get a bit of time to kind of get his insights. But then, yeah, that connecting with everyone else on the same journey, I equate it a lot to when my wife was pregnant. As much as I could be supportive, she wanted to talk to other people who were pregnant at the time, because they're the only ones that can really understand. Equally, when we've got a small child, you know, messaging someone at 3 a.m. in the morning because you're awake. And I think that's the other bit of those people who are on that same journey at the same time of whether it's a niche or not, or am I on the right journey, the imposter syndrome that kicks in, and all the other dilemmas you've talked about. So we've got another theme for this particular episode as well.
I will say I do appreciate the moment where you had mentioned, what are people doing right now? I feel like it ties everything up, because with niching, it's connecting that sense of purpose to what is everybody doing right now to the future. No pun intended, because Chris's thing is called the future. Oh my gosh. I swear that this is
very cleverly
not on purpose.
You should have owned it.
Oh, dang it. Really. Just kidding. I'm kidding. But yes, I totally feel you on that too, with like your wife needing to connect to a specific community because of that. And my partner is not an entrepreneur, but I drive them completely nuts talking about being an entrepreneur. I really try to like tune myself down, but it's really hard. Like, imagine rolling over and just going like, guess what? My post just hit so-and-so likes.
I mean, mine was like, I think the first cold lead that comes in and kind of like, someone messaged me without them knowing me at all to ask, you know, about a call. And they're like, what? You know, okay, I need to find someone else to tell this to. Nate. Right. So on that note, we're going to go and re-engage with our partners and tell them about our existence. Linda, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a delight. And we'll make sure that we put all of the links to Future Pro Group and things like that. And suitable content in the description as well. So thank you again for coming on, and have a lovely rest of the day.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run FutureTools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of Lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.